historically splendid abodes, the official podcast of Toronto Philippe. Exploring, if you will, practical philosophy, from science and the workings of the mind to spirituality, esotericism, and magic. Stooping down, dipping my wings, I came to the darkly splendid abodes. Plenty of emphasis gets placed on the importance of banishing rituals, especially as part of a greater overall magical ceremony. But not as much is said about purification and consecration, in spite of being integral elements of ceremonial magic. Edward Mason and I will take a look at these magical applications of water and fire. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
Love is the law, love than the will.
Welcome back, Edward. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good here today. It's a sunny day in Mexico, which is wonderful for the rainy season. And I've managed to kick enough dogs out of the house for the moment that they shouldn't interrupt me with barked comments.
Perfect.
The barked comments can be very helpful at times, but not during a podcast.
Okay, so today, speaking of cleansing the room of disturbances, from what I understand, we're going to be discussing the idea of purification today.
And consecration, because they are two things that in the Golden Dawn tradition are present in ritual workings. And what sparked it was going over some old diary material. In the Golden Dawn stuff, you know, you for each time you set up the temple, you do a lesser ritual of the pentagram, either invoking or banishing, depending. Then you purify and consecrate, and then you get into the stuff you're going to do. In the initiation, then there's actually the published Golden Dawn stuff in Rigardi, there are four different purifications and consecrations, gradually dealing with the different bodies, the etheric, astral, and so on. Or if you just want to be a bit less theosophical about it, you can just say, you know, getting deeper into the layers of the psyche. And for me, it was always, okay, yeah, you got to do this stuff. It's kind of, you know, tedious. You always have to do this. It's like, you know, you have to do the laundry once a week and so on. And it's not fun. Then I was looking at an old diary note about the first time that I tried Liber Samech. Now, Liber Samech promises that after 11 easy, if excruciating, months, you can come to the borders of full knowledge and conversation and, you know, cross that border, and then you get a visa and your passport, and you are now in contact with higher powers and everything's wonderful. I think my experience was the same as most people's, which is the first time you play around with it, you realize just how all-embracing that thing is, and you weren't quite prepared for it. You know, you still see people online, I'm trying to do Liber Samech, what do I need to know before I start? And of course, the answer is, well, pretty much everything. But what happened for me was, you know, trying to follow the written instructions. You did the usual banishings, purify and consecrate, so I'm doing that. And suddenly, those the purification and the consecration became doing previously to the main ritual. And I started noticing that it was something entirely different. And basically, if you my training was initially with a bunch of Wiccans who knew this stuff, and they would purify in the four directions simply by sprinkling a few drops of water in that way, and then they would use usually something with a flame on it to consecrate in the four directions. You can do it just simply by flicking three lots of water in the right directions with the Golden Dawn system, or an alternative system would be to trace a water triangle with your fingers and or with the cup. And then you could trace a fire triangle for the consecration with the censer, because in Golden Dawn we use incense usually to represent fire. I suddenly found that instead of seeing a sort of wave of water going out from me to the requisite quarter of the temple, I was seeing a sudden clarification of things. They were just becoming much more clear to look at, even physical objects in the space I use for a temple. Similarly, there was an agitation or enlivening with the consecration, and I thought, okay, this is really cool. I wonder what it's all about. I can be slow with this stuff. Now, remember, this is Liber Samech, and of course, the tarot card of Samech is the art card, where you have the figure of, depending who you say it is, Nephthys is a favorite figure, or maybe Diana, or somebody, some goddess figure, pouring water and putting fire into the cauldron together. They are critical elements of the ritual. They're not explicitly spelled out in that way in the actual written words of Liber Samech. So I assumed this was kind of the one of the subtexts. And it began to get me fascinated in something that really, frankly, bored me, that I must have done, 5,000 times over the years. And I started paying more attention to the whole process of purification and consecration after that. Crowley has some, I think, slightly turgid material in the book on purifying and consecration. He's going on about the necessity of things being absolutely pure. So he's not talking about the technicality of how to do purification, but on the fact that it's vital. And then a lot of what he's talking about in consecration is about sacred oil, rather than whether you're using a flame or you're using incense, which means that we're kind of on our own as far as official instructions from De Bos go for these things. So I thought, okay, I need to turn myself into an instant expert on all this, even though I thought I knew what was going on. Key thing with purifying has always been that you look at what we are told in the Book of the Law, which is the process of the cubs is in the coup, not the coup in the cubs, which means chapter 1, verse 8. That is, the star-like divine light in each one of us within of a, veils the human, the vehicle that each of us has, the spark inside. And so much of occult work is not so much doing cool magical stuff, although it does involve cool magical stuff, but simply cleaning up these folded veils of this coup, this garment or selfhood with which we've wrapped around ourselves. The whole point with Liber Samech would be getting to the essential angel being, presence, spark, essence, whatever term you want to use, which in order to survive within the human world has inevitably produced these veils in response to the various things that have happened to us in our lives. We learn that some things are a bit dangerous or make us unpopular. Other things are producing pleasurable results, and so we develop a personality. It builds up over a long period of time, but that becomes rather mechanical. And if you're going to get anywhere near K and C, you're going to have to sort this out and make these veils translucent or then transparent. And I realized that what I was seeing with this shift in the water that I was directing outward to the four quarters was actually making things look clearer. No, I hadn't actually attained sudden clarity to my whole being, but it was a good kick along the road.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, consecration is activating what's come through after you've got rid of a lot of the murkiness. So you are trying to, first of all, get everything more transparent, and then you're trying to get it all activated. That's not exactly profound stuff, except when it really hits you and you think, well, that's profound, because you hadn't looked at it quite in that way before.
Yeah, I find the common imagery that comes to mind, and I don't know if this will give us a bouncing off point for just sort of talking about it further, but like the idea of like a pool of water where you have a lot of kicked up sediment, and that sediment is sort of like the individual personality or the complexes, as Freud or Crowley might have said, sort of obscuring the starlight from within. And so like the purification process being kind of to settle that or purify it and cleanse it. And then the consecration, I don't know if this analogy is useful or if it can, you know, if you can contradict it in such a way as to find a closer analogy or anything like that.
No, it's the same thing. I used to use the idea of the muddiness of my own psyche as my own metaphor for this. But Crowley talks about making veils transparent. So I thought, okay, steal the boss's words, because, you know, that way you don't become unpopular with the more pedantic members of our audience. But yeah, you are dealing with muddy water. And also, you're looking, when you come to consecration, not to be stealing your personal energy, but allowing a more deep and vital energy to express itself through a clarified coup, through a clarified selfhood. You're trying to simplify and stabilize the personal self. And of course, anyone who tries something like Liber Samech is immediately introduced to all the instabilities and impurities that have hung on through years of magical practice and training and need to be addressed even more carefully and determinedly than we thought we were doing it when we got going.
Mm-hmm.
The great work, says Crowley in his commentary on the Book of the Law, therefore consists principally in the solution of complexes. Everything in itself is perfect, but when things are muddled, they become, quotes, evil. The coup is the first veil, far subtler than mind or body and truer, for its symbolic shape depends on the nature of its star. Now, I don't want to go on too much about Liber Samech, because the more that one person talks about their own experience, the more you feed ideas out there about, oh, this is what Liber Samech is. And no, it's a very, very individual thing.
Mm.
But it is something that is going to bring everyone at some point into contact with some really heavy, dark anxieties or negative traits in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The HGA expresses itself through every single aspect of our nature, and it's very easy to get caught up in something that obsesses us for years. I have an ongoing dialogue with a friend of mine who had encounters with the psychiatric community years ago. And I understand that was, you know, pretty upsetting for him, because, of course, what they did was just fill you with drugs and stick you behind a locked door. And, yeah, that was a pretty horrible experience. But for him, it taught him to be paranoid. And not just myself, but various other people in his circle have said, if you are paranoid about things, of course, bad stuff is always coming at you, because that's immediately what you focus on. And so his several efforts he's made at different spiritual paths appear to have just stalled, because pretty soon what he's bringing up is that tremendous depth of anxiety there. And I think what really stalled me that first time when I worked with Liber Samech was just very primal fear of being overwhelmed and crushed and destroyed. Mm. And after wrestling with it for a bit, I said, I don't want to do this right now. And I needed to, you know, regroup. And there's a whole other story that follows on after that that I'm not going to go into now. But I realized, okay, everything we do in magic is really one or another way of clarifying things, making things clearer for ourselves. And in the marvelous but very difficult instructions that Crowley puts for Liber Samech in the Scholion, he talks about all these different psychological processes that he refers to as individual minds. Go, and you need to just get them to do their own stuff, do what they need to do in your life. And only if there's a problem should it come into your consciousness. Otherwise, they just continue. You have needs for sexual interaction, human contact, food, sleep, cultural food in the way of music, art, literature, and a whole load of other more everyday but necessary things. And these individual mental centers in the psyche are taking care of this. They're not all necessarily directly operating in conjunction with one central light all the time, mm-hmm. even if ultimately that's the case. So there are all these different aspects of the psyche doing what they need to do all the time, and that's called having a human life. Mm-hmm. But the magician is trying to get to the point where all of these are ultimately coordinated towards one particular goal or group of goals that we generally refer to as the true will. You can't just get to KNC, I would say, simply by focusing on water and fire, purification and consecration. That's too easy. You have to include a lot more factors in order to get where you're going. But a simple glance at the Tree of Life shows you that you've got these two pillars at the side. On the one on the left, as you look at it, is water. The one on the right is fire, as you look at it. And in the middle, there is air, because air shares characteristics of both fire and water and can be a reconciliation point provisionally until you ultimately get to the element of spirit, which is marvelously undefinable, so we don't have to try defining it except by saying it's simply wonderful and don't leave home without it. That's what we're always trying to get done in our work, however broad and strangely meandering the actual workings we perform turn out to be. Just that oneness of being and a rootedness in the primal energy that, you know, we come from, each one of us. And of course, each of us has to determine how to deal with that and how to relate to that and how to remain connected to that. That is KNC, more or less in a nutshell. But you have to keep getting there by dealing with the two opposite, the complementary opposites of water and fire. So although banishing is moderately complicated, purifying and consecrating in a ritual is really very, very simple. It's a 90-second process in a small domestic temple. You just turn to the four directions and trace a triangle or sense three times, whichever you prefer to do. And it's taken care of, provided you stay focused on it. And yet it's very critical to anchoring the experience and the magical activity in the roots of its nature. The whole yod, he, vav, he formula starts off with yod and he, fire and water in our system. And without those two in reasonable harmony, you can have some fun, but you're not going to get too far. You're always going to keep going around in circles. One thing that I would add here is, like love under will, without each other, water and fire are ineffective. You can, generally speaking, see water as the love aspect, and it makes plain the hidden or scary stuff, and therefore it makes it possible to redeem that stuff from its obscure hiding place where it's hiding out and hoping it won't get hurt. And combine it with fire as the will, which will elevate it and lift it forward and at least give it a kick towards the direction of the stars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of sounds like you're basically using water to dissolve things so that you're breaking them up and freeing them from these locking points or these things that they get stuck in. And then, yeah, the consecration is actually giving them energy in a particular direction.
Yes, and the thing I think so many of us get caught up in this in very different spiritual traditions, there's this assumption that if there's a knotty problem in your psyche, if you do the right therapy, you can dissolve it. That's not what happens. What happens is it becomes plain, the anxiety, the difficulty, the problem aspects become plain. And with the addition of consecration, those elements that you've discovered can simply settle into the appropriate corner of your psyche. They don't go. They're not lost. You never really break down the personality structures entirely, but you can relax the tensions around them and make it possible to get far more spiritual force through. So to sum up, I think what really impressed me when I started exploring purification and consecration more intensely was that underneath all the things in our magic, the system of elements still underpins everything. The Hermetic Tree of Life, with its tarot attributions, goes back to the Golden Dawn, 135 years ago, not longer. Thelemic philosophy only came together 20 years after that. And things that we think are very ancient, like the systems of archangels and god names, they can't easily be verified prior to the 1200s of the Common Era, even if some of them do date back around the time of, you know, Jesus. So what struck me looking at all this was the elements have been there since the Axial Age, centuries before the Common Era began. And they are still the underpinnings of the entire system we have. You know, when I first got into magic, and we're going back 30 years now, everyone talked about the elements, and I said, okay, there's some writings or documents about them. And there was this kind of no response. And I thought, no, there's got to be something out there. And I got a document that said, well, you know, fire is hot and dry and water's cold and moist. And I thought, I discovered that when I was about 2 years old and the first time I burned my finger and fell in a puddle. This is not telling me anything. We still have to find out what these things are. If we're doing a standard initiatory path, then we work the bottom four Sephiroth of the tree. So we start with Malkuth as earth and Yasod as air and so on and so on. With Tefereth at that point standing in for the element of spirit, which is always completely undefinable. But the first thing, an obvious thing you have to come to terms with is that the physical elements in modern chemistry are fixed things. They're definable, they're observable. We can even take electron micrographs of them, you know, the actual atoms or molecules, whereas the classical elements are specific expressions of types of energy. It's not that they are so much as they are things that create certain results. So however sophisticated magical philosophy might become, it still relies on these basic elements of dynamic beingness. And all the complexity in the universe arises from combinations of the classical elements. So as we work through the system towards a gradually greater inclusion of supernal consciousness in our lives, and we begin to release that death-like grip on the mundane or conventional sense of selfhood, it's these elemental expressions that are being liberated. You know, fire and water, father and mother, which are Hokmah and Bina, emerge little by little. And they recede and come to the foreground again. It's a constant fluctuating thing, not a steady process.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those two elements in particular govern the two side pillars of the tree. So they govern the opposing aspects within ourselves, even if they do that at kind of a distance. Eventually, they do align, which means they're no longer locked into a mutually obstructive situation. And that means the HGA itself can manifest in the manner which it chooses to manifest. Mm-hmm. You cannot force its arrival. You can't predict it, or you can't really anticipate it. But regular practices do facilitate its manifestation. But it does take an awful lot of repetitions for that to happen. An awful lot.
It does sound like we're talking about like I think that can be a stumbling point for people, that idea that like trying to understand and pin down what like the elements are, you know, when you've got fire and water and air and these ideas. So it sounds like it's much less an atomic, so to speak, conceptualization like modern physics would be, where you've got discrete elements building things up, and it's more like a pattern kind of based idea.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it, the pattern. It is dynamic, but it's not a specific, easily identifiable thing. You know when you've been through a fire situation. You know when you've had a crazy day and it was an air situation in a negative sense because everything just was moving in all directions at once without any order to it. And you can have a day where things just seem slow and heavy and it just never seems to end. It's an earth day. That stuff you can identify. But there are much subtler levels to all of this. And, of course, purification and consecration are trying to address those more subtle levels.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the frustrating things about magical practice is that however self-controlled or calm-minded we become, we still have to keep on unearthing and calming these different agglomerations of the elements. Elements have force, and in a sense, there are locked up elemental energies functioning like sub-psyches inside of us. We can call them neuroses and so on if we want, but psychological terminology always has a slight accusatory character. You know, it's the modern equivalent to the sins of medieval sinners. You know, you have you've got trauma there, or you've got a neurotic symptom, or you have something compulsive that you feel, oh, I've got to fix something, mm-hmm. rather than simply accepting that that is an element of what you are.
Mm-hmm.
Magic has the advantage of viewing the insights we get into this stuff as achievements far more, I think, than psychotherapy does. Yeah, I mean, when people make a breakthrough in therapy, they're congratulated, but as magicians, we know you have to keep revisiting the same territory again and again. It doesn't just go away. Things don't resolve permanently.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why, of course, purification and consecration as the primary elemental operations that start off any magical ceremony or any magical working are the things that have to be repeated and repeated and repeated. What really struck me when I got into this sudden realization about it some time ago was this is not the chore that I always thought it was. It's something that is really valuable, and I was much more willing to participate in that after that point. Mm-hmm. It was something I could look forward to doing other than thinking, oh, I want to get started on my hexagram invocation, but I got to do all the housekeeping first.
Mm.
And that's really, you know, my primary point today. It was something that, sometimes you realize what seems to be not that important turns out to be a critical element that is worth valuing for itself, not just the fact that it has an effect.
Yeah, I have, I think there's like one common thing that's come up in nowadays is this mentality about like accusing there of being an overemphasis on things like banishing and presumably about things like purification and consecration and that sort of thing, which I think is like maybe just due to having a misunderstanding about the purpose of these things and the application of these things.
Yeah, I know that Nick Farrell was one of the people pushing this. You know, his teaching comes out of influence from Warira in New Zealand, and he says that the old adepts from that place downplayed regular banishing. They felt it dispersed your spiritual focus. He used a different term, but I think that was what he was implying. Which I thought was interesting because I have always started every morning, literally for decades, with a invoking pentagram. And at the end of the day, I do a banishing pentagram before the night. And it made me think, you know, maybe this is the problem. why am I not a full-blown Magus at this point, you know, running 15 orders just, you know, in between snacks? And perhaps that is something we need to look at. But if you value the thing as something contributing and recognize that it has a specific involvement in your ritual rather than it just being a chore to be performed, then I think things take on a different color and we can appreciate the whole process of magic much better.
Yeah, and maybe it's worthwhile not feeling like you have to be either on or off, you know, there's gradients to things.
Yes, good way of putting it.
Yeah, well, thanks very much. I appreciate your chatting with me about this subject today. And yeah, it definitely sparks off some ideas about other avenues of thought and that sort of thing as well.
Okay. Well, we'll try and think up something else even more complicated and obscure for the next one of these we do.
Sounds good. 93.
93.
Thanks for listening. Find Toronto Philema online. Like, comment, share, and subscribe, and help us grow. And join us again in the darkly splendid abodes.